This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Big, bold, progressive. Those are some of the words Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey uses to describe President Joe Biden's agenda as the president laid it out last night before a joint session of Congress. It was President Biden's first major address to Congress, and as with everything these days, the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic was clear. Instead of a standing room only venue packed with more than 1,000 people, only a couple of hundred folks were in the room, all wearing masks, and many members of Congress and invited guests were forced to watch the address remotely. Senator Markey, however, was one of those lucky enough to be in attendance last night, so we caught up with him earlier this afternoon to talk about what he heard from the president, what he makes of the administration's priorities moving forward, and what it was like to be in the room where it happened.
It was obviously a reflection of the times, you know, with the COVID protections in place. Each one of us had three seats between us. I was sitting up in the gallery with Elizabeth Warren, but three seats away. But ultimately, this address by the president each year is to the American people, to the people who are watching. And so to the members of Congress who couldn't get seats, I was lucky enough to get one. We're sorry, but ultimately it was the people sitting at home in their kitchens and their living rooms watching last night. And I think for, at least for many of the people in Massachusetts, I think they probably enjoyed this speech a lot more than they enjoyed Donald Trump's speech last year. And perhaps next year we can go back to business as usual. Although we'll just wait and see what the science allows us to do.
What do you think the key takeaway was for all those Massachusetts watchers in their kitchens and living rooms?
Well, I think it was a Massachusetts-directed speech. He talked about education. He talked about healthcare. He talked about innovation. He talked about the future. He talked about America taking on China, being competitive with China, having a plan to take on China. So I think the parts of the president's speech where he was saying we need to have 2 years of free pre-K, we need 2 years of free community college, he was just saying that it's not 1900 anymore. High school enough is not enough. We have to adjust to the world as it is in the 21st century. And I think on education, on child leave, on expanded healthcare benefits, all of those issues go right to the heart of the modern economy and what we have to do to adjust to deal with it. And when he spoke about climate change, we're not just the Bay State, we're the brain state in Massachusetts, and we believe in science and we believe in the need to have to deal with the consequences of the climate crisis. And then the answer is creating millions of new jobs, blue collar jobs, as the president said last night, a blue collar revolution to be able to solve this problem and export the technologies overseas. So I think from a Massachusetts perspective, it was a home run.
What does that look like for a blue-collar worker in Massachusetts? I mean, the president, for those listeners who didn't hear the speech last night, he was very clear in his connection between his approach to climate and American jobs. What does that mean for blue-collar workers in Massachusetts?
Well, you just start with offshore wind. The first 800 megawatts has now been green-lighted by the Department of Interior. And so we're in a situation where on that one project alone, there are 500 blue collar jobs that are going to be there for workers in Massachusetts. But as you know, the state of Massachusetts has also authorized thousands of additional megawatts of wind to be deployed. And the president has set a very ambitious goal of 30,000 megawatts off of the Atlantic coast by the year 2030. So for Massachusetts, that means potentially upwards of 5,000 to 10,000 new blue-collar jobs just in the offshore wind industry. So when the president said jobs, 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 blue-collar jobs, blue-collar jobs, blue-collar jobs, he's really talking about solving the climate crisis.
All right, so let's stay with what the president said government is going to do last night. You know, $2 trillion on infrastructure, almost $2 trillion for education, childcare, and healthcare in the American Families Plan. There's been a $2 trillion pandemic relief package. This sounds like a vision of big government openly embraced by the Biden administration. Is that fair?
Well, I think it's fair to say that we haven't seen a time like this since the 1930s, and we're in our own FDR moment. We're in our own Great Depression, combined with, by the way, the 1918 pandemic, the flu crisis of 1918. And I might add as well, we're kind of hearkening back to 1967, 68 in terms of racial issues once again percolating up to the top of our national agenda. So it's a time of a need for a great historic response to the problems. And I think that's what Joe Biden stepped up last night and delivered for the American people. And in the same way that FDR was told it was going to be too big, too bold, too much by more conservative forces, history has proven him to be right and his critics to be wrong. I think the same thing is true with regard to this bold set of programs that Joe Biden has proposed for our country.
So one of the things that I noticed in listening to that agenda laid out last night, I found myself wondering, what's the vision of the private sector that this agenda communicates? Clearly, taxation to pay for this agenda. But it sounded like a stipulation that the private sector isn't going to handle some of these key items, infrastructure, working class jobs, health care, and that therefore the government will. Is this a shifting in who we see as responsible for the social contract that was laid out last night?
Well, I would say there are certain areas where obviously the government is going to play a significant role. But in terms of the employment of Americans, especially blue-collar workers, in solving problems, no, that's going to be private sector as well. So, for example, the president inserted into his infrastructure bill a $25 billion climate bank, which for every dollar the federal government invests will unleash at least $7 of private sector investment. And the private sector needs a little bit of leverage from the federal government. But according to analysts looking at the economic results of having a climate bank, and I'm very confident that my proposal will ultimately become law, could potentially, if we can fund it up to $100 billion, create 4 million new jobs, mostly blue collar, over the next 4 years to solve the climate crisis. So I had a hearing yesterday. I'm the chair of the Climate and Clean Air Subcommittee, and I had a subcommittee hearing yesterday on this issue of a climate bank. And I will tell you, ultimately, I think it has tremendous potential for getting support on a bipartisan basis because it does unleash the potential of the private sector.
Okay, so I'm zeroing in on the tremendous potential for bipartisan support, which you can forgive an outside observer from saying, how is there potential for anything to have bipartisan support right now? For, you know, outside observers might see this as one of the most partisan times in Congress's history. How do you take steps forward to get a bill of that magnitude passed in this moment in Congress?
Well, I think you're right. I think that if passed as prologue, if what the Republicans did to Bill Clinton, the Republicans did to Barack Obama tells us anything, it's to just take advantage of the first 2 years of the president's term of office. So my view is we have to try to negotiate with the Republicans, but we have to put it on the clock. We have to say there's going to be a limit. We're not going to allow you to run out this whole year because we have to get big things done and get big things done now. And so to the extent to which the great Broadway play Waiting for Godot is relevant here. As we know, Godot never showed up on stage. And the same thing could be true for Republicans in terms of providing bipartisan votes for these big packages. And if that's the case, then the Democrats have to move forward without them. And to pass it with 50 votes and having Kamala Harris break the tie. And ultimately, if necessary, we have to repeal the filibuster so that on all these big issues, we don't have to be dependent upon 10 Republicans to cross the line when so many of them are avowedly committed to ensuring that nothing that is progressive becomes a law during the Biden years.
You just talked about 50 votes. $15 minimum wage didn't get all the votes on the Democratic side. How do you keep Democrats together when the spending bills are this big in order to get to the point where a vice president could break a tie?
Well, it's going to be a lot of work, a lot of hard work to listen to first Republicans. And then if they say no, that ultimately we have to work with all of the Democrats in our caucus, including Joe Manchin, with whom I've been speaking, to try to find common ground so that we can do these big things for our country. I think that what the president was speaking about last night goes right to the heart of the blue collar revolution that will be helpful to West Virginia, but also to every other state. And that's going to be our job.
West Virginia being Joe Manchin's state.
West Virginia being where Senator Joe Manchin is from, yes. So I think that we will have to work very hard, but ultimately I think we can be successful in keeping our Democratic coalition together.
You talked about putting a clock behind this. I also wonder if there's a ticking clock towards 2022 that is adding urgency to this agenda while there is a 50, you know, vote count in the Senate and without losing potentially additional seats in the House. How much are you feeling that sense of a ticking clock in trying to move this agenda forward?
I think that the politics of 2022 are going to be much improved if we've passed the earned income tax credit, if we've extended child tax credits, if we've put family leave on the books, if we've already created 4 million new blue collar jobs towards the goal of solving the climate crisis. So we've got a race against time. We have to prove that our theory is correct in terms of what will make America work better. And the sooner we get the laws on the books is the sooner the voter in 2022 can say, they made a promise, they delivered, let's keep them in office. So that's always a challenge in politics, but I think that the pace at which Joe Biden has been moving so far, thinking big, thinking bold, but also thinking that it's important to move with great political speed in the same way FDR did in 1933 is central to us holding on to the House and Senate in 2022.
I want to turn for a moment to less of a policy and more of a personal dimension to last night. I was struck in watching both President Biden and then Senator Tim Scott's response that there were tensions. There was disagreement, but there were also some common human themes. You know, watching President Biden acknowledging Mitch McConnell for naming a piece of legislation dealing with cancer after his son, Beau. And then some of the resonance of the notes from Senator Tim Scott. Here's a little bit of his message on being one family.
Our best future will not come from Washington schemes or socialist dreams. It will come from you, the American people. Black, Hispanic, white, and Asian, Republican and Democrat, brave police officers in Black neighborhoods. We are not adversaries. We are family.
I felt like I heard some of those same messages from the president, and both of those tones are remarkable compared to the tone of 2 years ago, let's say. Is there something starting to emerge here to build on and bring us back to a sense of shared commitment as Americans?
Well, I can only hope so. China believes they're going to win, if that's the word, because they're homogeneous. We only win when we recognize that what makes America great is our heterogeneity. And in order to be the dominant political, economic, moral, force in the world in the 21st century. We have to be more like us. That's who we have to be. And so to the extent to which we are a family and we understand that everyone is part of that family, that's what the president's programs are all about. It's making sure that every one of those family members, regardless of race, regardless of country or origin, are given a way so that they can fully participate in the American dream. And my hope is that as we move forward, that those on the other side of the aisle recognize that it was the Black and brown, poor and immigrant communities that were the essential workers over the last year who took the risks for our families, but it was their families that ultimately were exposed to the coronavirus, and that it's reflected in the policies, healthcare, education, racial, climate, economic justice, that we put on the books in order to reflect the fact that we are a family. And a big part of our family took a big risk for all the rest of us who could Zoom to work. And that if we recognize that, then we recognize what makes us great and what will make it very difficult for China to ever surpass us.
That is Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey. Senator Markey, thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on.